Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day, thanks to Vanessa from Banksia and welcome aboard the Starship Zero G, science fiction, fantasy and historical radio for episode number 1588 entitled Here's to World War None. Our podcast title is Potted Surprise. Now, I'm Rob Jan and our co-host Megan McHugh is leading an away team today. So we would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land of the Wurundjeri on which we gather today and broadcast from and to. We would also like to pay our respects to the elders past, present and future. Now, I have done my customary pass across the Eurovision song entries for this year, seeking genre or genre-adjacent content, most often in the costumes. The 2026 contest was held in Vienna, and I was yesterday old when I discovered that there are some particular rules to the thing, you know, beyond all the voting and all that sort of stuff. For example, there are no live animals on stage, though humans cosplaying as animals is apparently fine. Generally, there are no live instruments played, as it takes too long to plug and play them, and there's just no time between the act setups to do so. So mostly, not without the odd exception, any time you see someone playing an instrument, they're miming it. I have seen someone play an harmonica, and I think in this one there was a group that had a violinist on stage. But anyway, the lead vocal must be performed live, though backing singers can be recorded and mimed. And there are no children on stage either, a rule that came in more recently, though now there's a junior version of Eurovision for kids to participate in as well. And the maximum number of performers on stage is six, if you don't count the odd mannequins, puppets, holograms, or indeed one performer who was pregnant at the time. So I guess that's sort of six or seven, depends on how you look at it. And now, a track from the Interstellar Song Contest, which of course was an episode from the 15th season of New Doctor Who, or the second, I think the first Disney season, or was it the second? Oh, I can't remember. Anyway, featured the 15th Doctor, Shuti Gatwa, and his companion, Belinda Chandra, played by Virata Sethu. Showed up at a far future version of Eurovision writ large across a galactic stage and broadcast to trillions of viewers, written by Juno Dawson, the script was. She and showrunner Russell T Davies worked on some of the song lyrics too, music by the indispensable Murray Gold. Eurovision commentators Rylan Clark and Graham Norton both appeared in the episode as themselves through timey-wimey jiggery-pokery. So this song is called Dug-a-Doo, which I wonder, it could also be seen as Doctor Who, and features some colourful space avians and an incredibly annoying but catchy tune. So this is Dug-a-Doo from the Interstellar Song Contest. Reportedly, this particular track mostly was Murray Gold. I don't know if anyone else wants to own up to it. But you can imagine these sort of Muppety-type space birds doing this as they hone their beaks against diamond-sharp masses, no doubt, from the Interstellar Song Contest. And now I'm actually going to be seeing this in my head as a future version of the Doctor Who theme. Let's hope not.
Just how long have we been receiving these mysterious signals from outer space?
People of Earth, attention. This is a voice speaking to you from thousands of miles beyond your planet.
Hi, I'm Steve Squires. I worked on the Mars Exploration Rovers, Voyager, Magellan, and Cassini space missions, and I wrote the book Roving Mars. So if anyone should understand Zero-G, you'd think it would be me. Nah, sorry. Zero G, science fiction and fantasy radio on 3RRR FM.
Don't run, we are your friends.
Yeah, Dugadoo from the Interstellar Song Contest episode of New Doctor Who. It's 15 years or so now. Should we really still be calling it New Doctor Who? I don't know. I suppose, given the 900-year history of the Doctor, I guess that would be appropriate. Now, I just wanted to give you a quick mention. In the mix at the moment, running along from May 6 to July 26, is a beautiful tribute to the world of Studio Ghibli, which is being enacted every Wednesday and Sunday, with 12 films being shown in retrospective at the Lido Cinema. So just so you know that is on at the moment. I think they're going to continue on for quite some time, actually. That is at the Lido. All right, now looking at Eurovision here and having a look at some of the genre aspects of it this year. I usually do this, have a quick pass over it at this time of year. This time I first surveyed the official music videos for content, which you think would be more over the top than the stage performances. You'd think, and you wouldn't always be right. It's quite amazing how the performances often drastically evolve from video to stage as they nuance them and adjust them. As usual, I'm totally unconcerned with how the songs actually scored. I don't really worry about that, but I will mention that the Bulgarian winner, the band Dara, did have some furry cosplay seen in silhouette in the video of the banger hit Bangaranga. Look, there's pretty much always some goth or goth-adjacent groups in Eurovision. This year from Romania, Alexandra Capodanescu on stage strung its black-clad lead vocalist to the guitarist with glowing light ropes. Kind of bondage element with some decidedly Fifth Element-like diva warbling going on there. They were all in black and sort of kind of like leather or maybe vinyl sort of armour. Biz Gepa from Georgia said its big sharp-shouldered crew amongst brutalist black and white architecture, while also channeling Blade Runner and The Matrix with transparent plastic raincoats and oblong masks. By the time they got into the stage, they'd evolved into yellow, black-trimmed jumpsuits that would be perfect for anime mecha pilots, with chrome robots and Akira-like megacities projected behind them. Albania also had some Matrix-like code to run with sci-fi sunglasses on its, again, black-clad vocalist. The Austrian band Cosmo had some cool papercraft animal masks, which become way more shiny on stage, where its lead singer ended up with Bowie-esque face star makeup and also gained some armour as well. They just love to put them in armour. I don't know why. Serbia goffed out with a band called Lavinia and the song Kraja Mene with kiss light cozies and a whispery but prolonged metal shriek song that made me fear for the lead singer's vocal cords. They leant into the metal on stage complete with a sword in a stone and even bigger costume shoulders and longer clawed fingers. I kind of felt like this would have played well in the vampire court of Underworld. And Lelek from Croatia belted out a song called Andromeda. Cloaked priestesses sported henna face markings revolved around a pagan ritual in the woods where a woman and baby were pursued by a Nazgul vibing out rider. They lost the horse and the rider for the stage, but they gained more dramatic cozzies and smoke machine fog, a staple of most Eurovision performances. There were two songs that curiously rebelled against office cubicle life, as if. Simon from Armenia staged a Paloma Rumba rebellion, which translated neatly to stage, anchored by an office elevator set, and an amusing costume covered in post-it notes. There's a British group called Look Mum, No Computer, which had a more Tommy sort of punk rock opera feel in the video, with baked beans and banks of computers and a flying winged Mini Cooper. Some of this at least made it to the stage. Lithuania's Lion Cheska cranked up a silver-faced android-like character, which became even more androidy on stage. And Sarah Engels from Germany brung the fire in the video with an eponymous song that in the video saw them play with Fahrenheit 451 flamethrowers alongside some lyrics about a vampire, with the latter translating to the stage, but not the flamethrower, but they did have lots of flame pots anyway. Now, there was a song for Zero G co-host Megan McHugh, the Greek Achilles riffed off a side-scrolling video game animation set to some 8-bit notes, including a deep space game level with a rocket in it. So the stage's ginormous projection screens lent themselves very well to this, and I guess this is probably what I would say the most genre song in Eurovision this year. Furto from Greece by the group Achilles. Yeah, I kind of liked this one. It was bouncy and gave me some Super Mario sort of vibes. I thought I'd pop the song on today from the Eurovision. This is a karaoke version, because at the time when I got it, they hadn't actually released the full Eurovision album. So if you know the words, sing along. If not, just enjoy the tune and maybe side-scroll some Super Mario or something at the same time.
Captain Catherine Janeway of the Federation Starship Voyager. Zero G is fun, as you were.
Yeah, we had a little bit of Eurovision there. That was Furto from Greece, actually, the karaoke version.
Hello, darling. This is Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, stacking Z's on Zero G on 3RRR FM.
All right, so having a look at some of the genre aspects, and that particular one from Eurovision did have a lot of genre in it. It was a bit of 8-bit music there, mostly side-scrolling video game stuff, complete with a deep space level with a rocket ship and a moon man and so on. So that's probably the most genre one this year that I saw. Great video too for that one. And you can find all the video clips for that, plus pretty much the whole finalist show on SBS on their on-demand website. So I did like Belgium's Dancing on the Ice number, which they amped up on stage with quartz crystal epauletted costumes, shades of Frozen. And I got some good-natured Avatar feels with Eva Marriage's song from Luxembourg. His Mother Nature song had a whole Earth catalogue environmental feel to it, and a relentless smile from the performer. And the home team, the Australian entry, Delta Goodrem, powered through an astronomy-themed power ballad called Eclipse. In the video, this featured a mirrored column circle set on sand dunes, within which circle Goodrem played piano. On stage, the piano was sparkly gold and elevated, with Goodrem ending up on a platform above it. So I thought that was suitably science-based, at least, possibly astrology, but, you know, either science fiction or fantasy, I don't mind in this case. Special note, 2006 monster metal band Lordi made an appearance in the interval act, once again sporting their iconic monster costumes, but hilariously singing softer songs in the tribute to Eurovision's past hits, not hard rock hallelujah this time. Has it really been 20 years since Lordi won? Actually, also on the SBS streaming channel, they had an interview with Mr. Lordi, which I thought was quite interesting. So, yeah, Eurovision 2026 crept up on me this time. I actually didn't know it was on until this very weekend. Well, there you go. Still caught up with it at last. All right, let's have another song from the Interstellar Song Contest, the Doctor Who episode, which featured Eurovision on a galactic scale, sort of like Die Hard meets Eurovision, actually. And this was the moving tribute song to the planet Helia, a late entry song from Cora. And it's Cora's song from Doctor Who, the Interstellar Song Competition.
This is Peter Woodward. I play the Technomage Galen in Babylon 5 and Crusade.
And you are listening to Zero G. Who do you serve? And who do you trust?
A little bit from Doctor Who, the Interstellar Song Competition episode, their chorus song. All right, now turning to something a little bleaker than Eurovision, where we are being brought together by music. This is something completely different. It's a book called Angel Down, a novel. And it's by a writer called Daniel Krauss. And there's a bit of a story to this one. Well, it is a novel. But I want to take you first off to the Pulitzer Prize, which is, as you know, the premium literary prize, some would say on the planet, but at least, you know, the American one at least, which doesn't control the planet, but there you go. Given out for distinguished fiction published in book form during the year by an American author, preferably dealing with American life. So, okay, seen through that lens. And that, by the way, means that short story collections can win as well. How have they done with science fiction and fantasy and Pulitzer Prizes? Not particularly well. There was a 1925 novel by Sinclair Lewis, which either won or was one of the placeholders, which is actually science fiction, which is to say about the culture of medical science, featuring a plague doctor. In 1954, William Faulkner had a fable which was set, ironically, in World War One, and we'll tell you why it's ironic a bit later, which had a kind of a spiritual ending that edged it into the fantasy category. And in 1984, William Kennedy had a story called Interaction with the Dead. Also in 88, Toni Morrison had Beloved, which contained a notional ghost. Some sort of fantastical elements in there, a bit magic realism as well. In 2007, of course, there was the first big science fiction win, which was Cormac McCarthy's The Road, a post-apocalyptic science fiction story, which has since been made into a movie. You know, occasionally you'd have fantasy science fiction adjacent ones like a collection of short stories by Ursula K. Le Guin in 1996, which was called Unlocking the Air and Other Stories, which had stories in it which were neither science fiction nor fantasy, but still Ursula K. Le Guin had some of her own particular speculative fiction in there. This year, there was a runner-up called Stag Dance, or a finalist, I should say, a quartet by Tori Peters, which had at least one science fiction story in it. And before, once in 2007, Ray Bradbury was given a special citation for his distinguished, prolific and deeply influential career as an unmatched author of science fiction and fantasy, richly deserved. Now, whether or not I think that there should have been other science fiction or fantasy novels along the way, American ones that should have gotten a Guernsey, which is to say US-American, that is, not to override them over all of the continents, that's beside the point. The fact is that this year they did give the Pulitzer Prize to a novel which was all things, actually, in speculative fiction. There was science fiction elements, fantasy and horror as well. And the reason why the horror is set into it is apparent because it's set in World War One. Well, stretching from 1914 to 1918, that conflict quickly became referred to tragically, prophetically as the First World War, implying that there were sequels in the work, and so it proved. The 20th century industrial scale of the technology developed or refined for the conflict, coupled with the hideous death toll and particular horror of trench warfare, grimly inspired a vast output of related fiction and poetry, alongside straightforward accounts documented by combatants and non-combatants alike. It was all of a macabrely fertile field for speculative fiction too, providing grim inspiration for writers of science fiction and fantasy and horror. And most spec fiction about the First World War reads as cross-genre anyway, with the awful setting providing a baked-in horror element. And the influence upon speculative fiction and related media from the war is vast and ongoing, a kind of narrative hammer that rings to this day and doubtless into the future. Many post-war scientific romances were written by people who had lived through the war and had something to say about it and its effect upon the future. And, you know, there's so much that we could go into for this. I'll just mention a couple. 2017's Wonder Woman movie was set during the so-called Great War, though I suspect that that was largely the case because Captain America, the first Avenger, had sort of vacuumed up the content for World War II. And Kim Newman, British author, set a whole novel of his Anno Dracula saga there, where vampires are incorporated at various levels into the war, because in his Anno Dracula series, the British Empire has been overtaken by vampires and Queen Victoria is held in thrall by Dracula himself. H.G. Wells, of course, projected a series of continuous global conflicts in the wake of World War I in his story The Shape of Things to Come, which is published in 1933, set as a kind of a future history stretching up to 2106. And the wars got progressively worse and more civilization destroying until a world order of aviators managed to save the day and lead mankind into a glorious space-borne future. Doctor Who has had plenty of intersection with World War One. There was even a Doctor Who comic book that I think had a Rose Tyler, one of the Doctor's companions, masquerading as the Angel of Mons, of which more later. She had to sing a song to prevent a battle between British and German armies in 1914. There's a episode of One Step Beyond, that anthology series, called The Vision, where four French soldiers in World War One pacified by an amazing sort of enthralling, enlightening, literally light that they see above the battlefield. They stop fighting and abandon their post, which lands them, of course, a cowardice trial, a court-martial, sentenced to death, but they get spared when an enemy soldier who also saw the miraculous vision arrives. And this is, again, highly relevant to Daniel Krauss's Angel Down, which we'll get to in a bit. So, yeah, I've seen so much stuff set in World War One. That was that movie Biggles, which sort of time-travelled from there. Not a particularly great movie, but some interesting ideas, and should have been played a little bit more straight. As I said, Doctor Who, other science fiction shows have visited World War One, especially time-travelling ones, as they will. And it's often used as a metaphor for pointless sacrifice and bloody horror in those shows. I could go on, but I'll let Wonder Woman do some talking for me here. Rupert Gregson-Williams has the iconic soundtrack here from the Wonder Woman movie, Wonder Woman's Wrath. And this is obviously going to have the stirring moment when Wonder Woman goes over the top of the trenches in World War One, charges out with her shield before her, accepting and deflecting bullets with that shield and her magic bracelets, as well as knocking aside a few shells too. A great scene, and actually poignantly reminiscent of Blackadder going over the top in that television series World War One episodes. Very sad story. If only they'd had Diana Prince in front of them during their charge over the top. So Wonder Woman's Wrath, Rupert Gregson-Williams is the composer of this one.
Hi, my name's Con Eagledon. I'm the author of The Dangerous Book for Boys and Wolf of the Plains, and you're listening to Zero G on 3RRR.
Yeah, Wonder Woman's Wrath there, Rupert Gregson-Williams from Wonder Woman movie, from the original motion picture soundtrack album there. She goes over the top in World War One. I remember that scene vividly from the movie, of course. She ploughs out into no man's land. Well, she's a woman. So, and she is the Wonder Woman, so she's able to field all of those bullets and bombs being hurled across the battlefield at her. Always remember the jump that she does all the way to the church spire that you can see just beyond the battlefield. Possibly a little bit anachronistic there, because most of the church steeples around World War I battlefields were flattened because they made two good observation posts. Perhaps a little bit of artistic license taken there from the film. Anyway, we are talking about World War I because of the newly fledged Pulitzer Prize winning speculative fiction novel Angel Down by Daniel Krauss. Hot off the presses, actually. Only won the award the other week. So, all right. Daniel Krauss was born in 1975 in Michigan in the United States. Known for horror-adjacent stories, basically, as well as general speculative fiction. He's published 22 novels, including Whale Fall in 2023, which is also being made into a film. I should say that Angel Down as well has also gotten its film rights nabbed. I was doing a survey of Pulitzer Prize winners in the fiction category, going all the way back to the 20s, and didn't find too many speculative fiction ones in there. Some with fantasy adjacent magic realism elements, of course, but most notably the Cormac McCarthy post-apocalypse science fiction novel The Road. But in this case, this is one with all multi-elements, science fiction, fantasy and horror. Where does Krauss come from in his writing? Well, he has seen George Romero's Night of the Living Dead several hundred times, the great seminal modern zombie movie from the black and white catalogue of George Romero that started off his own saga of zombie movies, all spinning off of that particular tale. Krauss also wrote extensively about Night of the Living Dead in essays that have been collected, and also co-authored a book in 2020 called The Living Dead, which is kind of an extension of the story itself. So some amazing work there. Highly recommended if you're a zombie fan. That's The Living Dead by Daniel Krauss and George A. Romero. We actually reviewed that one on Zero G back in the day. Krauss also collaborated with Guillermo del Toro on a book called Troll Hunters, which has been adapted into a Netflix animated series as well. Other books that he's written, that is to say Krauss by himself, The Monster Variations, Rotters, Scowler. He also wrote free graphic novels, and he's got a non-fiction book coming out this year as well. Whalefall, by the way, is coming out this year too as a movie which the author has worked on. There is an audiobook available for Angel Down 2, which is narrated by US-American actor Kirby Hayborn. I actually read the Angel Down on Kindle, had a different experience to either of reading in a printed book or listening to it as an audio adaptation or seeing it as a film either, or a television show. Who knows where these things all will end up. It's a film, actually, in the case of Angel Down. So, okay, awarded the 2026 Pulitzer Prize for fiction was Angel Down. Now, it's a World War I novel written as a single unbroken sentence. And that form of unbroken sentences, well, we've seen that before in novels going back to Virginia Woolf's The Waves or Mike McCormack's Solar Bones, or if you're familiar with Isabel Allende's The Infinite Plan, they are all that sort of thing. And that one continuous sentence prolonged throughout a novel does, of course, give you a sense of immediacy and kind of an access to the stream of consciousness of the point of view character in this case. That continuous stream of consciousness sentence flows like the muddy water that the World War I French battlefields that the story is set in lie drowned in. As the author says, it's a sentence in a book careening without periods, gasping with too many commas, a sentence that once begun can't ever be stopped, a sentence doomed to loop back on itself to form a terrible black wheel that sooner or later will drag each and every person to a grave. A bleak story. It's set in the Miss Argonne campaign in France in World War One. 2 weeks in, there's an American infantry company bugging out of its previously entrenched positions, making a strategic withdrawal. And while on burial detail, a shell lands nearby the burial party and obliterates everyone in that party. But one man is not killed or even wounded, and that man is Private First Class Cyril Bagger, who's a con man and a card sharp, both before, during, and he hopes after the war, when he hopes to exploit the spiritualism trend, which he knows will be a growth area after the slaughter of everyone trying to contact their lost loved ones. Now, Bagger has a shame fly stuck within him, which is all that remains of his father murdered on the sunken passenger liner, Lusitania. And his father was a preacher, and the shame fly made Bagger enlist. Possibly not his finest moment. A lot of other infantrymen owe Bagger money, which he takes as in kind, basically substituting other people for him in battle. So he's been lucky so far because of that. He has them go over the top instead of him. I don't know how he wrangles it, but he's obviously a bit of a fixer. So Bagger prefers to be on the burial and latrine details in the rear of the unit and not in the front line. This comes to the attention of Major General Leon Rees, who wears his medals to the front line while he's in uniform, which is probably not a great idea because of snipers, but nevertheless, he's got a space there for the yet unattained Medal of Honour. Yes, he's one of those commanders. He's got his eye on Bagger when a non-stop shriek across the battlefield prompts the Major General to volunteer five misfits to stay behind while the rest of the unit withdraws from the trenches to find what he thinks is a stricken, wounded American soldier and help him, which is to say, put him out of his misery. Now, the five chosen could just sit around after the unit bugs out, knowing that the major won't be there, but it's possible that he might send a runner back to check on them. And if they are found to be disobeying orders, then it's court-martial all round for disobeying and likely execution by firing squad. So, over the top they go, just like Blackadder and his men, but without Wonder Woman to help them. Well, actually, they didn't have that either, but, you know. So who's in the group apart from Bagger? Lewis Arno, a 14-year-old underage soldier, lied about his age, who's kind of Bagger's closest friend on a battlefield, apart from his father's red leather-bound Bible. And speaking of books, Bagger reads books to the illiterate child soldier, Lewis, particularly Tarzan ones. But he adds his own fictionalized riffs onto them just because he can and because he's a con man. Lewis is probably the most innocent of the soldiers, if anything, if that can be said of anyone who's in World War One, perhaps just because he's the youngest. Then there's Vec, an African-American flamethrower operator made nervous by both his hideously dangerous job and extended combat trauma, shell shock, as they used to call it. He's on loan from another unit and he's brought his PTSD with him. Although there's nothing post about Vex's trauma, he's up to his neck in it constantly. There's Vincent Goodspeed, who is a soldier who keeps miraculously clean on the battlefield, who saves his money, and he has a lot of it because he's also known as Vincent the Vulture. He loots corpses, sells and trades souvenirs. Along with Hugh Popkin, a soldier who's made miserable by his, I think, assumed girlfriend back home, whose claim that she loved a fighting man chivied him into enlisting to show his courage. He is anything but courageous. Then there is the next character who will be found in the battlefield, the Angel Down of the title, an enigmatic character who becomes a mirror and more than that to the five soldiers who rescue her. There are elements of science fiction, fantasy and horror in this story, and of course any story set in World War I where you encounter what they call battlefield gothic, the horror of what men and their machines of war do to each other, well, that's fully in play here. When I was reading the book, I had the curious feeling that maybe I'd be catching some anachronisms in the story. I looked a few up, actually. They mention agitprop, which is kind of a propaganda, and that turned out to have been invented back in the day too. And they also mentioned just offhand tinker toys, and again, something that was mentioned back in the day. So after a while, I stopped trying to catch the anachronisms and just settled down to grimly enjoy the flow, the non-stop flow of the story, because it is a single sentence. I think it's a harrowing novel, really. It gives you so much to go on from the era, if you're familiar with the tropes in the media from films and television shows and literature and indeed poems of the First World War. I remember that was one of the books we studied in school. It's there steeped in the mud and the blood and all of the grisly horror of the entire thing, which is curiously contrasted with the character, the angel, who is the main MacGuffin of the story. And that's got its own particular origins as well in a, what we call it, a battlefield legend about the Angel of Mons. The Battle of Mons took place in August in 1914. And there's a myth that's grown up about it that there were angels and spectral bowmen who appeared over the battlefield and saved some outnumbered British troops. And it is a fictional story. There was a Welsh author, Arthur Machen, who had a short story, put that into the London Evening News in 1914, which was, you know, about sort of the Agincourt archers. That got picked up by spiritualists and churchgoers and so on, and became this sort of a spreading legend that did have an effect upon morale in war-beset Britain at that time. So, yeah, this obviously riffs off of that legend to a great degree. Is it worthy of a Pulitzer Prize? Well, I don't know. Although I've read many of those novels, Grapes of Wrath, To Kill a Mockingbird, and of course Cormac McCarthy's The Road along the way, and several others too. I think it is. It's a strong story. It's rich in detail. It's poignant. It's horrible. The science fiction elements do come into play when they start talking in metaphor about the war to end all wars, which of course it was not, and the fantasy element, well, you know, the sort of religious element of having an angel appear on the battlefield, well, you know, obviously that's a fantasy type thing as well. It's very thoughtful. I could not put it down, possibly because that single sentence just won't let you put it down. You just keep going until you stagger to the finish. I would recommend it. It's a strong story and a good one, well told, Daniel Krauss really hitting his straps with this one. An amazing piece of work. Angel Down, and it is available in various formats. I think it was first published by Atria Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster, in July 2025. And now the winner for the 2026 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. I thought about the track to play to come out of that, and the one that occurred to me was The Angel of Mons by Sol Bliss, who's an industrialist balladeer from Bristol in the UK. And this is a track called The Angel of Mons, and it's from his Great War prog rock album, I suppose we should categorise it as.
Hi, this is Michael Palin, and right now you are lucky enough to be listening to 102.7 3RRR FM.
Yeah, you were listening then to Sol Bliss's The Angel of Mons from his Great War prog rock industrial album there. Just riffing off, having looked at Daniel Krauss's Pulitzer Prize-winning speculative fiction novel, Angel Down. Well, that's about it for Zero G today. I think we'll go out with an anti-war song, David Bowie's Fantastic Voyage from the Lodger album from 2017, remastered version, actually, of that one. And that's about it for Zero G for today. Thank you, listeners. And thank you, Joe Brunatic, coming up next with Astral Glamour.
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of RRR's Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on RRR from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the RRR website.